From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Both Reverends Jesse Jackson and Ben Chavis held meetings this weekend in Chicago. We'll take a look at African-American organizing in the 1996 elections. And terrorism at the Olympics means anti-terrorist legislation in Congress. What will this mean for civil liberties here at home? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. With the bomb attack on the Olympic Games and the possible sabotage of TWA Flight 800 fresh in their minds, Western ministers today called for stronger international cooperation to fight terrorism. Foreign and security ministers from the Group of Seven industrialized nations in Russia hope today's gathering will help improve joint anti-terrorism efforts. The United States is represented by Attorney General Janet Reno and Peter Tarnoff, the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. Meanwhile, in Washington, members of both sides of the aisle in Congress will be meeting to discuss anti-terrorism legislation. Yesterday, President Clinton met with congressional leaders to talk about such legislation. While that was happening in Washington, late yesterday afternoon, I went down to the federal building here in New York City where the INS is housed. That's the Immigration and Naturalization Service. There were dozens of protesters there, mainly Haitians, and they were saying, how is it possible that if everyone is speaking against terrorism, that President Clinton has released Emmanuel Constant? His nickname is Toto. Emmanuel Constant is head of the Haitian paramilitary death squads that during the coup were responsible for many killings. He was also on the payroll of the Central Intelligence Agency. Jacqueline Joseph was one of those who were protesting down at the INS building.
There is something I can understand. They're fighting the terrorists. They want them, right? The government, the American people does not want terrorists here. Come, they put Toto under their bed to protect him. Toto is a terrorist. Toto is a criminal. Toto kills more than 5,000 people. They protect him. They have to send him back.
Refugees, yes.
And that was Jacqueline Joseph protesting outside the INS building in New York City. Emmanuel Constant, the agreement reached between the Immigration and Naturalization Service and Emmanuel Constant was just released in the Baltimore Sun on Friday. It said that Emmanuel Constant can, quote, self-deport, go anywhere he wants in the world. Meanwhile, the NAACP is condemning the willingness of Atlanta Olympic officials to let a Savannah Yacht Club with a history of discrimination play a role in the Games. Even though organizers promised to sever ties with the Savannah Yacht Club, the club is operating a fueling station for numerous boats shuttling spectators, media, and supplies the few miles between the Olympic Village and the Olympic yachting course. 2 years ago, it was reported that the club held a state land lease but had no black members. Atlanta Games Chief Billy Payne assured the International Olympic Committee that the yacht club would play no role in the yachting committee. The club first accepted its first black member when the State Human Relations Commission started an investigation into club membership policies in 1994. And President Clinton is hosting a White House meeting today for Egypt's president. Hosni Mubarak is expected to argue that Israel must trade land for peace if the Middle East peace process is to survive. You're listening to Democracy Now! This past weekend, Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition held a convention in Chicago to discuss its strategy in this year's election. At the same time, in the same city, the National African American Leadership Summit, led by ousted NAACP Director Benjamin Chavis, held a hearing to talk about issues facing black Americans in this election year. Here to discuss these developments is Ronald Walters. Dr. Walters chairs the Political Science Department at Howard University in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Walters. And we're also joined by Salim Wakil, my co-host in Chicago. Salim is a senior editor at In These Times and is a columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Salim.
Good morning, Amy.
In fact, Salim, you wrote recently a piece about African-American organizing and what's happening with the African-American convention that you and I discussed with Ben Chavis just a couple months ago.
All right. It seems that increasingly Ben Chavis is being really dictated to. That may be an unfair way to put it, but I'll say it this way. Basically, Louis Farrakhan's lieutenant. And that's understandable because the Nation of Islam is really providing much of the wherewithal, both financial and physical, for much of the African-American Leadership Summit's organizing efforts. So he's really beholden in many ways to the Nation of Islam. And that's pretty apparent in the plans that he's making. Because at first, as you remember, he talked about this convention. And then when Minister Farrakhan said talked instead about the July convention, which was just held this weekend, he changed his tune a bit on that.
You know, Salim, maybe we should say something before we get into a discussion about African-American organizing with Dr. Walters, and that is, actually, we have changed today's program. We originally intended to interview, at the beginning of the program, Gary Franks, the black conservative Congress member from Connecticut. He's written a book called Searching for the Promised Land, an African-American's Optimistic Odyssey, which both you and I have been reading. But we got a call late yesterday afternoon from Congressman Franks' office, or from his publicist for the book, saying that he had canceled this long-planned interview because he had voted against Pacifica's funding in Congress just a few weeks ago, calling us hate radio, and so he refused to come on. I thought it was interesting, Salim, that when I was reading the book, he was boasting in the book about going on Rush Limbaugh's program and how much attention he got for it. But he can't see coming on a radio station where you actually conduct a civilized discussion.
Exactly. And that's, I mean, that, again, that's one of the dead giveaways, really, of how insecure many black conservatives are in expressing their views, because they find that it's increasingly more difficult to justify many of the positions that they've been taking, especially in regards to the way even the Republican Party has been acting. I mean, they're undercutting many of the black conservatives' fervor and for support for anti-affirmative action measures, for example. The conservatives are kind of running away from that, or at least moderating their stance, and many of the black conservatives are going full steam ahead. So they're being cut. Their legs are being cut out from under them, and so they find themselves in an untenable position often.
You know, another thing that came up in his book that he was boasting about at the end of a very heated controversy he had with the Congressional Black Caucus about letting him in as a Republican. At the end of it, he said while he got in, he helped to ensure that the CBC, the Congressional Black Caucus, lost their $200,000 in funding at the beginning of the Republican Congress.
Right. Amazing. He's an amazing guy.
Well, we're sorry we didn't get a chance to talk to him. I feel that it's his loss, and maybe at some point we'll be able to go up to him in Congress and maybe get a comment from him there without him realizing quite who it is he's talking to. Well, let's move on now to Dr. Ron Walters, political chair of the Political Science Department at Howard University. Dr. Walters, you were in Chicago this weekend. What transpired there?
Well, the Rainbow Coalition had a meeting. And what they sought to do was to bring together politicians from around the country, delegates to the Democratic Convention, and some, I should say, probably to the Republican Convention, because it was a nonpartisan meeting, and to talk about the strategy for going into the campaign this season, including the convention. You know, generally, in the past, it's been a habit of progressives and people in the African-American community to meet on the night before the convention, have a big, great meeting and try to worry about whether or not they were going to see the president and so forth. Very little strategy. Well, this was an effort to try to put together a series of public policy workshops, very excellent workshops, carve out of that some public policy positions, and to try to get some semblance of a political strategy straight for many of the people who were going to participate inside the convention.
Dr. Walters, you were one of the original planners of the National African American Leadership Summit's efforts to do something similar to what you just described. Are you now, or do you consider yourself no longer involved with that effort, or are you still somewhat connected?
Well, it's not a question, I think, of being connected. I take my participation with them as with the Rainbow on a case-by-case basis. When I think that they're doing something that I have time to participate in, and that I think it is credible, then I will certainly join it. The accident of this was that at the time I was called to participate in it, the Rainbow Coalition had already sent its letters out to people and had a venue, and the planning was far along. So I think that here I was already committed to one meeting, and I decided, since I was playing a fundamental role in that meeting, to actually stay with it.
Do you find that, you know, the Chicago papers played it up as Farrakhan, Jackson split on election plans? I mean, they didn't even mention Chavis. They simply went to Farrakhan and said that there seems to be a major divergence in strategy, that Farrakhan is advocating a stay away from both parties, a third force strategy, while the Rainbow Coalition is thoroughly in Clinton's camp. Is that how you see it?
Not quite yet. I think that what Reverend Jackson is obviously trying to do is to say, look, there are at least two, maybe three credible options for this campaign. One of them, of course, is going to have an impact on the public policy and therefore the quality of life for progressive people, minorities, the poor, the kind of people the Rainbow Coalition represents. So what is our choice? It is prudent for us to make a choice, not stay home, and therefore we ought to prepare ourselves to deal with it. So on that basis, what he is saying is that Clinton is the choice, clearly. His program is better than the Republican program. It is certainly better than anything that we've seen that the National Reform Party is coming up with. And so Clinton clearly has to be the choice.
In fact,
now, the issue is this. How do you get there? What I've advocated is a parallel campaign, which is to say there are huge parts of the Clinton agenda that we cannot as progressives run on. And therefore, it was incumbent upon us to meet to decide, what was our campaign about? On what basis were we going to go to the people? So I think this is really what it's all about. And I think we've gotten a long way as a result of this meeting to meeting with mayors and people like Congresswoman Maxine Waters and Mark Morial, many of the people who were there at this meeting, to try to decide what that strategy was going to be.
In fact, Dr. Walters, yesterday on Inside Politics on CNN, Judy Woodruff was questioning Jesse Jackson about what she was calling a split. She was asking if he is on a collision course with Louis Farrakhan, with Ben Chavis saying that African Americans, their vote should be up for grabs. And Jesse Jackson, on the other hand, she was questioning whether he is saying, you know, basically African-Americans are in the pocket of the Democratic Party. And while he said, no, our vote is up for grabs, he did emphasize this.
If Democrats regain the Congress, Charlie Rangel would become chair of House Ways and Means Committee. John Conyers, Judicial Committee. Ron Dellums, the Armed Services Committee. People like Lynn Woolsey and Maxine Waters and Henry Gonzalez will move up. And so while there's the Clinton-Dole dimension, there's an even bigger dimension as to the Congress and key state legislatures and the judicial appointments.
And that was Jesse Jackson speaking last night on CNN. What about this? You know, he was emphasizing the fact that, for example, Senator Dole didn't even go to Ron Brown's funeral, the former Commerce Secretary, and that there was very little that the Republicans had to offer. But on the other hand, looking like they are not in the pocket of the Democrats, so that President Clinton can do anything he wants and know that African Americans have nowhere else to go.
Well, I think that strategically, and this is one of the things I think that came out of this meeting that I was a part of, I think we agreed upon, is that the focus of our strategy is re-empowering the progressive coalition in the Congress. I think that if we do that, and he started to mention the names of the people who would take over major standing committees of the House of Representatives, if we were successful in re-empowering the, for example, the Congressional Black Caucus and the Hispanic Caucus, and those whites who were in urban districts and who often vote with blacks and Hispanics. That number is somewhere over 60, between 60 and 80 members of the House. If we were successful in re-empowering the progressive coalition, we could, from that base, then hold any president who sat in the White House accountable. So for us, he is right. It is far more important that we turn out blacks, not just in those districts where blacks are in the majority, but also in those marginal districts where we may constitute 20% cutting-edge difference in the vote, to turn out and vote for progressive Hispanics and progressive whites to try to get them back in the Congress. Now, having said that, I think, that we must also say that I don't really believe that the black vote is up for grabs. As far as I'm concerned, there is no grab in the Republican program. There is no grab in Ross Perot's program. So for me, I'm clear about, if I vote, what I'm going to vote for, and I'm clear about that right now. But the issue is, how do I get there? So to that extent, I think that Minister Farrakhan is within his right to say that there is tremendous discontent in the African-American community about what he has seen so far in terms of the politics of this season, and to organize not merely a counter-politics, but it may even be a parallel politics on that basis.
So you're in many ways encouraging that particular strategy.
What I'm saying is that I think that it is a logical product of what we have before us. We have a group of people who obviously, over the course of the last 30 years, have gained an inside position inside the Democratic Party, inside the administration. They have a responsibility to exercise some leadership from that posture in this campaign season. On the other hand, we have people who are suffering at the base, who are bearing the brunt of all of the indignities that are being heaped on them by the society. And if you're telling me that they don't have a right to get mad, and they don't have a right to question the political allegiance of both the Democratic and Republican Party, if you're telling me that, I see you wrong. There is a politic there that needs to be expressed. And what I'm saying is that I don't see that as necessarily a contradiction to the politics of the responsibility of those people who find themselves on the inside.
Professor Walters, what about President Clinton's view on welfare? I mean, it's not exactly clear, actually, what it is. He talks about with affirmative action, mending it, not ending it. On welfare, he says he likes what he has seen of what the Senate and the House has passed, but although he has problems with some of it, it's not clear if he'll veto it. I think he is waiting to test the political winds. But what kind of comment do you think he is making to poor people, many of whom, a disproportionate number of whom, are people of color?
Well, yes. When you look at the people who are on welfare, 38% black, 24% Hispanics, 60% of the total, 40% white. We have a vested interest in how this welfare bill comes out. And I think that what the president is doing is to trying to get himself in the best political posture to deal with it, because he understands that welfare is unpopular with those people who are going to vote. And so I think that what he's doing is trying to wait to see what the conference comes out with. The welfare bill is now in conference. Both the Senate and the House have spoken. In the last week, many of us have been lobbying to try to say to the White House, some of us have written letters, others of us have called, to say that in this atmosphere, the president cannot afford to come down on the wrong side of the welfare reform package at the same time that we are meeting in Chicago to try to figure out our strategy to vote. And so we've tried to make that very crystal clear, as clear as we could, that the welfare reform bill, which comes out of the conference, if it does not have in it adequate support for job training, adequate support for daycare, adequate support for those people who find themselves off of welfare after the limit, the 2-year limit or the 5-year limit, those things are not there, then it seems to me that the president has no alternative but to veto it if he is interested in the interest of his constituents.
And if he doesn't veto it, what alternative do we have?
Well, we've not made welfare a litmus test for whether or not we're going to vote for him.
That would be one thing,
and I think what he has to do is to judge the fact that there will be a lot of people who will make it a litmus test, which is to say there are a lot of people who may not vote, who may slip away, and he may need those votes in marginal districts. Take a place like Louisiana. The last time, 1992, something very historically important happened in Louisiana. It gave its vote to Bill Clinton on the basis of the fact that most of the vote in that state came from the African-American community. For the first time in history, over 50% of the share of a president's vote was African-American. Now, if he wants to toy with that particular constituency and go along with the welfare bill, which shoves 1.6 million children off of the rolls by his own department's estimate, and alienate those people who are gearing up to go to the polls, it seems to me that that's not a good political choice.
Professor Walters, we're going to have to stop for a minute, and then we're going to come back with Salim Wakil in Chicago, Professor Walters, Chair of Political Studies at Howard University. We're talking about African-American organizing in this 1996 election year. After that, Congress is meeting, and we're going to be talking about what they're meeting about today, and that's anti-terrorism measures. We'll be speaking with a civil libertarian. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman in New York. Our New York studios at WBAI, and Salim Wakil is with us from Chicago. And we're joined in our Washington studio by Professor Ron Walters, who formerly chaired the Political Science Department at Howard University in Washington, D.C. And speaking of Ron's, last week there was a coalition of groups that gathered in Washington for a news conference. And Ron Daniels, who is a former presidential candidate with the campaign for a New Tomorrow, spoke. He was talking about the Cash in the Check campaign.
My name is Ron Daniels, and I am the national convener of the campaign for a New Tomorrow. I was also an independent candidate for president in 1992. In 1987, I was executive director of the Rainbow Coalition, and in 1988, I served as the deputy campaign manager for the Jesse Jackson for President campaign. We and the Campaign for a New Tomorrow, which is an independent, black and people of color-led, multiracial, independent political organization that seeks to build a new independent political party, are here to join in this campaign to cast a check. Because as Reverend Sharpton, who has eloquently laid out the conditions, has indicated, we face a state of emergency. Black America is in a state of emergency. And it is a state of emergency exacerbated by the Republican contract on America and all of the right-wing white supremacist elements which are, in fact, encouraged by it, and the tragic acquiescence of the Democratic Party, which for many, many years has been the repository of steadfast and loyal support on the part of African Americans, has acquiesced, has rolled over, and indeed is racing with the Republicans to the right as a way of garnering support within the electorate. Indeed, we now find race, the question, the politics of race, dominating politics in terms of how it is used opportunistically by both political parties. We are here determined that whomever is elected, be it a Democrat or a Republican, will have to deal with the outraged and enraged African-American community around its agenda, an agenda which will not be, in fact, addressed unless there is the kind of protest at the Republican and Democratic conventions that we envision. We are determined to see to it that the check, which Dr. Martin Luther King alluded to so eloquently in 1963, in fact will be cashed. And indeed, reparations will be an integral part of those considerations. I would remind you in closing that in 1968, as Dr. Martin Luther King prepared to deal with the Poor People's Campaign, as he was assassinated in Memphis, he was upholding an economic bill of rights. An economic bill of rights, which is something that America seems to have forgotten. Issues of full employment, quality education for all, question of housing, the eradication of poverty. He understood the need for these basic human rights to be guaranteed to all human beings. This is no longer a part of the public discussion in terms of America. And then finally, I would say that because of the collapse and failure of both parties as it relates to black people in this country, and indeed, as Tom Wicker has pointed out in his book, The Tragic Failure of Integration, there is a need for black people to move beyond the Democratic and Republican parties to create a more visionary, fighting, transformative political party that indeed will not only rescue African Americans, but will fight for all oppressed people, poor and working people, and all of those who struggle for a just and humane society within this country.
And that was Ron Daniels, who is with the Campaign for a New Tomorrow, Executive Director of Center for Constitutional Rights. And he is part of the Cash in the Check campaign. We're now speaking in our Washington studios with Professor Ron Walters. And we've got Salim Wakil with us from Chicago. He raised the issue of race being an integral part of this campaign. Yet it's interesting that both Republican and Democratic leaders have pledged that they won't use race baiting in the 96 presidential campaign. This according to black mayors yesterday, who were meeting in the National Conference of Black Mayors. I was reading Bob Woodward's book, The Choice, on Dole and Clinton, and he was saying that when Dole came out and said he wanted to repeal affirmative action, Bill Cohen, the senator from Maine, the Republican, came up to him and said, you understand what you're doing here, that you're using code words, that affirmative action is simply code for going after the issue of race. Do you think race is a major part of this campaign, Ron Walters, although it's not being raised in the same way that Willie Horton raised it years ago?
Yes, and there was a recent editorial in the Washington Post just 2 days ago to that effect. I think that, one way to use race, obviously, is the negative way. The Willie Horton ads in the past and these things that have come about. But I think at a time when we're seeing this massive wave of church burnings, and many of them black churches, behind that, of course, is a very silent discussion. And that is the issue of the racial climate. I think that there is a moral responsibility, not just political, but a moral responsibility for political leaders who would head this country, lead this country, to talk about the racial climate in the midst of this campaign. And yet there is silence on this. So I think that race certainly is driving many of these issues. When you look at the what I call the race-coded issues of welfare reform and crime and affirmative action, they're talking about race, except they're not using the word. So I think that it's it would be an act of courage, really, for one of these candidates to pull it off, pull the covers off, and begin to talk about what really vexing America, because a lot of Americans out there believe that it's really black people or Hispanics really the cause of their problem. I think that the courage and statesmanship would be to set the record straight. Irvin Jackson really recently went over to Japan, went over to Indonesia to try to say that the root of this problem really is runaway corporations who are pitting low-wage labor markets in Asia with low-wage labor markets in America. Somebody ought to deal with that discussion, because that is really the root of a lot of the economic tension and therefore the racial tension in this country. But nobody has engaged that discussion.
Well, the person who was engaging in it was Pat Buchanan, and he got the attention of many working-class whites in the country, and the Republican Party, in fact, even shifted a bit of its rhetoric toward the populist end during his campaign. But Buchanan, of course, used also many racial code words to get the people fired up. And it seems as if those progressive issues only are effective if they're coupled with the kind of closet racial overtures that people like Buchanan make. What do you think are the prospects for the kind of coalition efforts between people who share economic interest, black and white?
Well, I think somebody has to begin to make that argument, and I think that's where again the strength of the Rainbow Coalition comes in, because it's making that argument. It's not just Buchanan. When you go, you know, Buchanan didn't go to Asia. Reverend Jackson did. And I think that that discussion has to burst upon the scene before and be legitimized by somebody. They're quiet in the religious community about this issue. They're quiet, you know, in the academic community about these issues. So somebody has to really begin to join at the level of legitimacy of this argument before other people will come along.
Dr. Walters, do you think the Rainbow Coalition should become a rainbow party? I mean, what about Ron Daniels quoting Tom Wicker talking about this third party?
Well, Ron Daniels and I have been engaged in that enterprise for 20 years, he and I. And he was at this meeting doing a tremendous job on providing leadership for confronting the problem of black church burnings. But we were involved in the 1980 project of starting the National Black Independent Political Party. So Tom Wicker comes very late, you know, with that strategy. We've done some hands-on work to try to do it. And then, of course, Ron ran for president. I think that that is a viable strategy. And if you read my own book, Black Presidential Politics in America, let me get that in.
Excellent book, by the way.
Thank you. Spent a whole chapter talking about that issue of independent black politics and as one of the things we need to do to build our leverage in the political system. So we've been out there struggling with this for years. The issue is, and my frustration is that it seems to me that that discussion only emerges in the midst of a presidential election year. And I want to say to all of my friends, progressive, unprogressive alike, I just banged on the table for effect. We cannot form an independent party in the middle of a presidential election year. You've got to start that 4, 5, 6 years out, pretty much like the new party has been doing it. So that if we're very serious, we will start that on November the 6th, not in 1999.
Well, we're going to have to leave you on that note. Professor Ron Walters, who's former chair of the Political Science Department at Howard University and author of a book on black presidential politics. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, Salim Wakil with me in Chicago. And we're now going to turn to an issue that Congress is taking up today, that President Clinton took up yesterday as he met with congressional leaders from both sides of the aisle to talk about the issue of terrorism. The bombing at the Olympics this weekend has once again spurred calls for a new crackdown on terrorists. The administration has renewed its request for expanding wiretapping powers and marking explosives with identifying chemicals. But NOD Coalition of Civil Libertarians and the National Rifle Association has vowed to block some of these efforts, although they divide on others. Don Rush has this report, and then we'll be joined by a civil libertarian, someone who has a long history in Congress, to talk about the issues of anti-terrorism legislation. Don Rush.
This has got to be a long, disciplined, concerted, united effort by the United States. And I think we ought to take every tool we can and take every possible advantage we can, because this is not going to be easy. But we have shown that we can get results when we work together and do the right thing and the smart thing.
The bombing at the Olympics in Atlanta also found a more pliant Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, the most prominent Republican from Georgia. Over the weekend, he suggested that a deal might be worked out on some of the items that Congress dropped from the terrorism bill.
This unites all Americans in their commitment to make this country safe and to protect innocent people.
One of the top items on the president's anti-terrorism list is tagging explosives with chemicals that would make it easier to identify the source of a bomb. But the National Rifle Association was able to get Congress to delete the provision from the Anti-Terrorism Act. Bob Walker with Handgun Control Incorporated.
The issue of tagging some black powder has been studied now for over 20 years, and most of the experts out there believe that it is doable. It has been doable for some time now. The opposition, the NRA, we believe, is not based upon the technical problems that might exist, but rather because they object in principle to the use of tagants and explosives.
But the NRA says its sole concern is safety. Spokesman Tom Wild points to a study by the Office of Technology Assessment.
The OTA found and demonstrated in tests that there was risk of accidents from both the manufacture and the use of powders that are tagged. Essentially, the chemical in the tag combines with the chemical in the powder and causes a destabilizing effect that can result in injury and death for millions of Americans.
Walker counters that the OTA originally found such tagants to be feasible, but buckled under NRA pressure. For civil libertarians, the president's support for expansion of wiretapping power is far more serious. The proposal would allow so-called roving wiretaps that would give the FBI the authority to listen in on any phone used by a suspect. Laura Murphy with the American Civil Liberties Union says for every wiretap that is used, over 1,500 innocent conversations are overheard. In addition, she says, less than 0.2% of all wiretaps used by the FBI are against terrorist-related crimes like arson, bombing, and firearms violations.
This is a big joke, a big myth, a big hoax being pushed on the American people that this wiretapping is A, effective, and B, going to do anything to stop one crazy person or a group of crazy people from engaging in a terrorist act.
But those involved in intelligence work abroad say such security measures can be highly effective in combating terrorist groups. Stanley Bedlington, formerly with the Central Intelligence Agency.
If you put the United States in comparative perspective with other countries in Western Europe who are democracies, which are democracies, you will find these countries have imposed really draconian counter-terrorist laws, which would make the ACLU squirm. And they have worked pretty well insofar as terrorism in these countries has been diminished considerably. And there has not been any major erosion of essential democratic values in those countries.
But that's a mistake in comparison. I don't think we need to make that comparison.
Marcus Raskin with the Institute for Policy Studies.
What our standard should be is an old one, which is the maximum amount of freedom for people.
Raskin notes that infringement on individual privacy is a growing phenomenon within the United States, especially by private business. He also believes the fear generated by the Atlanta bombing will have consequences beyond the immediate moment.
This obviously increases people's fear. And as you know, the kinds of fear and insecurity which exist in American life then become fixed on not only on general fear, but they can be fixed on these particular events, which in a sense take their minds off of other sorts of economic and social fears that they have.
Don Rush, Pacifica Network News, Washington.
And thank you for that report, Don. I'm Amy Goodman with Salim Wakil, and we're now joined by Jim Dempsey of the Center for National Security Studies. Mr. Dempsey was assistant counsel to the House Judiciary Committee's Subcommittee on Civil and Constitutional Rights from 1985 to 1994. His primary areas of responsibility were oversight of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, privacy, and civil liberties. And yesterday, he and a group of others gathered at George Washington University to talk about what is going to be an onslaught of so-called anti-terrorism legislation. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jim Dempsey.
Good morning to both of you.
Well, why don't you tell us what you expect to see introduced into Congress, what the president will be supporting, and what your concerns are?
Well, the danger in the area of terrorism or any of these other areas that are so fraught with emotion, the danger is that we reach beyond the issue of terrorism and would enact provisions that really have nothing to do with terrorism, but that seriously chip away at our civil liberties. We saw that in the anti-terrorism legislation that was signed into law by President Clinton this past April. Some of the most destructive provisions of that legislation had absolutely nothing to do with terrorism. For example, a provision that essentially gutted the historical right of habeas corpus, which was the procedure by which federal courts enforced the Bill of Rights in state court proceedings, ensured that the state courts adhered to the Constitution in the application of the death penalty and in other criminal cases. That right was seriously cut back. That has absolutely nothing to do with terrorism, since terrorists are not tried in state court, they're tried in federal court. The legislation enacted in April also had provisions targeted at legal aliens, aliens suspected of and accused of absolutely no involvement in terrorism. And now we're seeing those provisions being applied to arrest and detain and deport aliens who have been in this country, perhaps for many years, have established lives for themselves, have jobs, are paying taxes. And because they were convicted of a crime, in some cases a very minor crime, for which they serve their sentence in jail, they've paid their debt to the American society, they are now facing a total disruption of their life, arrest, and deportation. That has nothing to do with terrorism. It was enacted in the emotionalism of responding to this issue, and I'm very afraid that we would see that again.
Jim Dempsey, we have to break. Jim Dempsey's with the Center for National Security Studies. We'll be back with him in just a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! Listening to Democracy Now!, where citizen action matters most. I'm Amy Goodman with Salim Wakil, our guest Jim Dempsey of the Center for National Security Studies. You were talking about the measures that, in fact, don't fight terrorism. Well, yesterday, Senator Orrin Hatch, head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, was on CNN's Larry King Live. And clearly, the right in Congress is in a bind. A number of Congress members, a number of senators get a lot of money from the National Rifle Association, and they don't want anything cracking down either on explosives or that prevents in any way people from getting even assault weapons. And this is what he said is the main problem and has to be attacked.
I think we've got to reexamine some of these criminal laws. You take the Miranda rule. When somebody gives a voluntary confession, that ought to be admissible into evidence. Frankly, the Miranda rule has been used day in, day out by defense lawyers in the Oklahoma City bombing case. And it's delayed it. There's no quick justice there. There's no quick getting to trial there. And a lot of it comes down to some of these technical rules that really favor the criminal rather than the public. You take the exclusionary rule. The exclusionary rule excludes evidence that that may have been gathered in good faith by the police, but there may have been a technical mistake in doing so. We've got to allow the courts to function, and we've got to get some reason into this system.
And that was Senator Orrin Hatch. Jim Dempsey, your response.
Well, that, I think, perfectly illustrates my point. In the context of the Atlanta City bombing and the suspected terrorist attack on the TWA flight, if that proves to be terrorism, we see instead Senator Hatch and others attacking fundamental principles, fundamental elements of our criminal justice system, protections that arise in every single case and that really have nothing to do with terrorism. And yet we see an effort to use the emotionalism of the moment, the justified emotionalism of the moment, that people are upset and frustrated, but we see this effort to take that and use it to cut back on very, very important protections in our system, the very elements of our system that we should be most proud of and the things that we should look to as our strengths, that is our respect for the rule of law, our respect for due process, our tolerance, our diversity, the principles that we try to enhance and realize every day. Those principles come under attack at times like this, in the name of fighting terrorism. Actually, it's an attack upon our fundamental values.
Jim Dempsey, but you know, when I hear Senator Hatch talk, it's really he's simply repeating a kind of mantra that he's been repeating for many years. What is new, though, is that there are right-wing and conservative politicians who are also very much concerned about this encroachment on civil liberties. What I haven't heard, and that you know, the strange spectacle of the ACLU and other conservatives joining together, but what I don't hear, though, is the similar kind of concern coming from the progressive wing of American politics. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, you know, it's interesting. To some extent, the conservative liberal terms have lost a good deal of their meaning when you look at questions of government power. Certainly, President Clinton has proposed a number of very significant expansions of government power, not only in the terrorism area, in the law enforcement area generally, in other areas of social control, where he has endorsed the creation of very significant computer databases for suspected youth gang members and
He supported other sweeps in Chicago housing projects.
Exactly. So the I think the best way to look at things is, how do people view a government, and do they remember the dangers of government intrusion and the difficulties, really, of holding government accountable? Now, when you say the progressive community hasn't been heard from, there are actually things going on. The progressive community, I would define broadly. For example, one thing that I should mention, the American Muslim Council has joined together with a number of other organizations, including the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights, to create a hotline. They have a toll-free number, which I will give out. It is 1-888-2, just the number 2, Rights, R-I-G-H-T-S, 1-888-2, Rights. And this is a number that is open not only to members of the Muslim community, but all persons who have been harassed or questioned by the FBI in pursuit of this latest terrorism legislation. What the AMC, the American Muslim Council, is doing is collecting reports of incidents where FBI have approached persons on a little suspicion, largely because of their religious or ethnic background or their political activism, to ask them questions about their activities under the guise of investigating terrorism. As soon as this law was enacted, a number of groups got together back in April and said, we have to watch very carefully how this legislation is being interpreted, how it's being enforced. We need to monitor the activities of the FBI to be immediately aware when they begin overreaching, when they begin going into various communities with widespread questioning of persons.
Jim Dempsey, let me ask you something. You were with the subcommittee that dealt with issues like privacy and civil liberties for, what, 9 years in Congress. When were the times that so-called anti-terrorism legislation was introduced, when restrictive civil liberties legislation was introduced, and what forces were at play there? You were right in the middle of it.
Well, we have really seen, we've gotten ourselves into a cycle where every 2 years, actually, we have a major piece of anti-crime or anti-terrorism legislation that is coinciding with the congressional election year. We have we saw in 1986, I think it was following the U.S. involvement in Lebanon and the bombing of the Marine barracks there, we had a major piece of counterterrorism legislation. Other very serious expansions of government power and uses of more arbitrary sentencing practices, such as the mandatory minimum sentences, which have such a devastating effect in the African-American community, particularly really introduced a major unfairness into our criminal justice system. Those came up, of course, in the name of fighting the so-called war on drugs. So we have seen over time a number of different rationales and justifications, whether it's organized crime in 1968 when wiretapping was first authorized in the first omnibus crime bill, or drugs and now terrorism.
I was just reading accounts of the COINTELPRO, some of the tremendous excesses that were committed during the COINTELPRO program, which was the counterintelligence program during the 60s and I think early 70s. Do you, during your period of oversight of these federal agencies, law enforcement agencies, can you respond to suspicions that people have that such that kind of program like the COINTELPRO program is still going on in various guises today?
Well, I think on the one hand you have to, recognize that things are not as bad as they were in the time of COINTELPRO itself, when the FBI was out harassing everybody from Martin Luther King to the Black Panthers to anti-Vietnam War groups and feminist organizations and a whole range of organizations, specifically trying to disrupt and discredit those organizations, to sow dissent, to create...
To neutralize.
To disrupt, to neutralize were the words used in the COINTELPRO instructions. Mm-hmm. The breadth of that type of intrusion and that attack upon political activism is, I think, not present today. However, the philosophy of COINTELPRO, the ideological focus, I think still retains, and we do see reemergences of a COINTELPRO attitude. We saw it, of course, in the 1980s with the wide-ranging FBI investigation of CISPAS, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, and other groups. I think there were 260-some solidarity groups that were investigated nationwide by the FBI during that period, groups that opposed U.S. Policy in Latin America and our support for the military regimes there. During the period of the Gulf War, the Operation Desert Storm, the FBI went out with a very overbroad interview program directed at the Arab American community, and we tried to call them to task for that and held a number of press conferences to blow the whistle on that effort.
Jim Dempsey, let me ask you a tricky question, and that is, right now, the conservatives in Congress, a number of them, are very concerned, as are progressives, about cracking down on civil liberties. Do you think that they would be as concerned about this, that they have a history of concern about this, if the people that were being cracked down on weren't the white supremacists or the Freemen or the people at Waco, but in fact were, let's say, African-American, were Black Panthers? Do you think you'd have the same kind of reservations that they have now if that were the case? Did they ever speak out when, for example, it was learned the full extent of the COINTELPRO program?
Well, you know, I will find my allies where I can find them, and if a neoconservative is a liberal who's been mugged, then I think a neo-progressive may be a conservative who's been arrested. I think that the essence, of course, of the civil liberties perspective, in my view, is the ability to look at another person who's totally different from you in some respects and to say, that could happen to me, and to make that connection across boundaries of race and class and religion, and to understand that the loss of civil liberties by one is a loss of civil liberties by all, and that what happens to another person leaves me less free as well. But if it takes the experience of it happening to one of your own to make you understand the danger of unaccountable government power, then I'd say, fine, let's now come to an understanding and see what is the problem with giving the government power, and how you see even people of very good will misuse that power. I think Waco and Ruby Ridge were eye-openers to many on the right. I think for many on the left in the African-American community or the American Indian community, those things were not eye-openers at all. They were repeats of incidents that had occurred before.
What do you expect to see right now in Congress? We're going to see an effort to mark, chemically mark explosives, which I assume a lot of people actually are for. I know the National Rifle Association isn't.
I don't see a big civil liberties problem with that one, actually.
And number two, the issue of wiretaps on roving phones, not just that you can get a warrant to, you know, go after one phone number, but that now with the use of cellular technology, everything.
Yes. Those are two of the provisions that have been used. By the way, Amy, just to correct a misperception, the roving tap authority actually has nothing to do with cell phones, although it's often talked in those terms. It turns out that actually a cellular phone is easier in many respects to tap because, of course, the person carries it with them and you tap the conversation off of a central switch, not off of the airwaves, and the phone really does not present a problem. The roving tap problem has to do with people who use payphones.
Right.
That authority is actually already on the books, has been since 1986 with a strict standard. The president is asking to loosen that standard. Those are two of the issues that have come forward. I'm afraid there are others lurking in the background here in some legislation that's been introduced that go even further. One provision that would allow an FBI agent in the field at the supervisory level on his own signature to be able to require businesses to turn over records, mm-hmm. hotels, motels, bus companies, package delivery companies like Federal Express.
I'm surprised considering Filegate that that would be passed.
Well, and to do that without a court order, which of course has always been one of the key protections that we have looked to, the intervention of a judicial officer when the government seeks to seize evidence, the president in whose White House Filegate occurred, is now asking for authority for FBI agents to obtain those records without going to a judge and without showing the need and the relevance of that information. There's another provision here that really, in my opinion, goes to the integrity of the wiretap process, which is a provision that says that if evidence by wiretap is seized in violation of the law, if the various protections there are not adhered to, the evidence is excluded. It's a little bit like the exclusionary rule that Senator Hatch was, in fact, I think, speaking against in the clip you used earlier. The president would eliminate that protection and require a person to show, to prove bad faith on the part of law enforcement in order to keep that evidence out, which really removes any incentive.
Jim Dempsey,
law enforcement,
we're going to have to go, but I do want to ask if you'd like to repeat that 1-800 number if people want to get information on the kinds of legislation and the kind of efforts that are being used now to deal with them.
Well, now, I would not want them to call this number looking for information on the legislation. This is if you've been visited by the FBI, if you're a member of a activist community or a religious or ethnic community and you feel that you're being
Jim Dempsey, I'm going to have to cut you off because
we're
just about to go. Dempsey with the Center for National Security Studies. Thanks, Salim. I'm Amy Goodman. If you want our number, 1-800-735-0230. Thanks for listening to Pacifica Now.